Bruce Pratt joining us for Sports Lit 101 this afternoon. And we've talked about this book a couple of times before, but happy to have the author back with us for, I think, a third appearance here on the program. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Iowa. His most recent book, ABC Sports, The Rise and Fall of Network Sports Television. And today we talk about his terrific book, The Boxing Film, A Cultural and Transmedia History. Travis Vogan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Really is a wonderful and fascinating read and reminder that the idea of boxing on film is, well, pretty much as old as film itself.
Yeah, it sure is. And it kind of helped to get film rolling, really, and to define film as a popular spectacle for entertainment. I mean, when film started, it wasn't totally clear at the outset what we were going to use it for. It could be a scientific instrument or, you know, something of that nature, and not necessarily something that we were going to use for entertainment. Boxing kind of helped to usher it into that designation.
And one of the great things about the book for me, Travis, was that you came at this essentially from four different angles and created one big picture. I mean, you talked about how boxing films evolved, how they influenced society, how society influenced them. But I love the way that you tagged in with the pay-per-view and the boxing on TV and the like. And I think a lot of people didn't. I'm old enough to remember the Friday night fights, but most people don't.
Oh, wow.
And what effect that had on sports broadcasting?
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the things, too, about this book is that boxing sits at the foundation of film, and the film is kind of the focal point. But those stories that we started using boxing to tell wound up impacting the development of radio, the development of television, and then the development of cable television. And even now, in the last couple of years, some of these subscription streaming services like DAZN and even ESPN Plus have invested in boxing to kind of get off the ground. So you really see boxing kind of operating at this, as this kind of way to boost emerging media in a really unique way.
I also thought that it was quite interesting the way that you showed how boxing films sort of mature over time, that they start out either trying to tell a story in a fictional way or they create a story, but over time they begin to tell a story that shows where boxing fits in our culture.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the sort of prototypical boxing film is, you know, a scrappy, almost always white guy who's faced with some kind of moral choice or corruption. In the earlier ones, it's like, will he throw the fight or will he maintain his integrity? And while those are uplifting stories in a lot of ways, they also kind of reinforce these ideas of who we imagine should be placed in these heroic positions. And a lot of times they didn't reflect the reality of boxing. You know, I mean, if we just watched boxing films, we would think that the best and only boxers to a large extent are white, for instance, which we know is not the case, very much not the case. And so how do boxing films tell these stories that reflect really important things about our culture, like sacrifice and hard work and the idea of meritocracy, but also reinforce certain inequalities in our culture regarding specifically race, but also class and ethnicity and those kinds of issues as well.
I thought it was fascinating how film, well, I guess for lack of a better term, made a black champion acceptable to much of white America in the way Joe Louis was portrayed.
Yeah, that was a fascinating part of the book to work through. I mean, Joe Louis, his whole identity as a celebrity, and he really was a kind of celebrity as well as an athlete, was sort of formed in reaction to the controversy surrounding the first black heavyweight champion, Jack Johnson, who was really boisterous, really kind of in your face, very rebellious, and was seen as a real threat not only because that he was so successful in the ring, but that boxing was kind of this symbol for masculinity and power. And there were these racist attitudes that suggested that black people should be subordinate to white folks. And then what does it mean when you have this black boxer, you know, very easily winning the championship? You know, it kind of flies in the face of that. And there was a lot of controversy. And actually, the films of Jack Johnson competing were banned from interstate transport, so they couldn't be shipped, and so they were essentially unprofitable. And so Joe Louis really had to face all that kind of stuff when he became champ. And the films that were made about him kind of reflect some of those instances. On the one hand, there were films that were, at the time, they were called race films, and they were kind of independent productions that were geared toward African-American communities. So smaller budget, more niche productions that were kind of using him to tell these tales of uplift. And then there were these other films that were really carefully situating him as non-controversial. He was even in this kind of World War II film called, what was it called? called This is the Army, where he was sort of championing, you know, his role in the military and suggesting that he wasn't a threat, but he was a patriot and all of these kinds of issues. And so his role in the sports film was really kind of informed by that history that he was tied to by virtue of Jack Johnson as a precedent to him.
I was thinking about just that when I was saw the other day, I was going through some books, Floyd Patterson's autobiography, memoir, and how they sort of played him as Joe Louis against Ali as Jack Johnson.
Yeah, that's very true. And that strain, you know, is something that can obviously be traced through the history of boxing, but also through the history of boxing films. And you go all the way to somebody like Muhammad Ali, who was treated, you know, in this very similar kind of way. He was a fascinating character, but he was somebody that, at least in mainstream America, we were a little bit uncertain about. And even a film like Rocky has been, which we all know, has been discussed as kind of a reaction to Muhammad Ali, right? You have, all of a sudden, you have this white underdog kind of coming out of nowhere to beat Apollo Creed, who is this really, like, handsome, media-savvy, funny kind of black champion. And so Ali kind of is repeating that story in certain ways and updating it. And you can even apply it to, like, well, he's a different case. You can apply it to, like, Mike Tyson in the 80s, too, right? How these black champs kind of emerge, and you see this sort of ambivalence surrounding them in culture. And you see boxing films kind of grappling with this and how they're representing boxing. And a lot of times they grapple with it by elevating, you know, white champions as protagonists of the films. And Rocky is, you know, the most obvious example.
We're talking with Travis Vogan about his new book, The Boxing Film. Travis, how important was boxing to the success of the HBO network?
Oh, it was absolutely crucial. I mean, HBO was just like one of those in the 70s, you know, it was just an obscure media outlet, and even pay cable was obscure. And so they had to find a way to get people to buy subscriptions, and they didn't have, you know, this was before The Sopranos, before Game of Thrones. You know, they didn't have these big popular properties, and so they invested in sports, and people were already kind of going to see closed circuit exhibitions of big fights. Like the more, it's kind of like today, where the kind of run of the mill fights you might see on ESPN on a Saturday night or something like that, you know, like a middleweight contenders who have some promise. But the big fights are more typically going to be on some kind of pay-per-view. And that was the case in the 70s and 60s to a certain extent, but they would show them kind of as like simulcast, and you would go to a theater or some kind of public place where you would buy a ticket and watch it on a big screen. And so HBO was kind of adapting that model to cable, and that's how they started to create their subscriber base. And really, you could say that boxing is the thing that got HBO off the ground. I mean, that, I would argue that, and I don't think it's much of a stretch. Certainly would not have had the same history and would not have got off the ground in the same way were it not for boxing.
Back when there were three major networks, at some point in the book, you pointed out that like 40% of what was being shown was sports. And I think people don't realize that now we see sports everywhere. I've got 8,000 channels that have sports on them. But we went to bed, the TV went off at midnight, came back on 7 o'clock in the morning, and somewhere in between they had to fill a lot of stuff. And at night there was a lot of sports.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sports is flexible. You know, it's live and it's conspicuous. And it's something that attracts it has a tradition of attracting a male audience, which is an audience that advertisers really champion, especially back then, when men had more kind of relative purchasing power and they were a stronger kind of demographic market. And yeah, I mean, earlier on, and this is probably the most obvious part, is that sports and boxing in particular are really easy to show on television in comparison to other things. You know, you don't have to build a set. You don't have to do costumes. You know, people are already wearing their costumes. The lighting, at least in boxing, is already really great. And it's indoors for the most part, so it's not going to rain. And so all you have to do with boxing is point a couple cameras and you're ready to roll. Now it's changed, and I think people who run sports know how valuable their properties are. But at the time, you know, they would just send camera crews down to Madison Square Garden or St. Nicholas Arena or wherever and throw it on TV, and it was real successful. And of course, they had to make these things entertaining. And so a lot of the times what they were doing is they were telling stories about these folks, and these stories were informed in large part through a lot of these boxing films. And boxing films gave the sport kind of viability on television that would make people interested in checking it out.
A confluence of events led to the waning in popularity of boxing with, you talk about in the book, the legal troubles that Mike Tyson got in, the realization of what happened to Muhammad Ali due to the number of fights and the blows that he took through the years, and then the rise of MMA and other types of combat sports. How in those situations did boxing films help to try and expand that base and as you point out in the book, expand the demographic of boxing?
Well, I mean, one of the funny things about boxing films is that while we've seen kind of a waning of the sport of boxing, we haven't really seen a waning of the boxing film as a genre. Strangely, there are just as much of these boxing films being made as ever, even as the sport itself has kind of suffered. And one of the things that boxing films have done is they've both adapted to and kind of reflected on and tried to recapture this history of boxing or this idea of boxing that they represent. Because in a way, boxing films never really are about boxing, right? Nobody boxes like Rocky. If anybody did that, they'd be dead within a round, because you just can't box like that. It's not even close to how people box. And so they're about stories, right? And so, in certain ways, you see films kind of adapting. Like there's a film like Warrior, which was kind of about MMA, I think it came out in like 2011 or something like that, 2012. And it was basically a boxing film, but it was about MMA. And then there are films like Creed and Creed 2, which are kind of updating the boxing film through that really familiar kind of template, still relying on that kind of Rocky world, but updating it in a way that's kind of stylistically and culturally a little bit more reflective of the 21st century. And then there are films like Southpaw, which I think, I want to say it was 2015 with Jake Gyllenhaal, which is basically like just a combination of all of these boxing film cliches. And it did, you know, it did pretty well. And so it shows that it has this kind of endurance as a genre. And there's still consistently, you know, several boxing films made every year. Not all of them are very successful, but they still keep coming out.
I thought one of the really great analyses you did in the book was of the movie Raging Bull, which at the time stepped a little bit outside the traditional boxing film genre and conventions. Do you think that was that film was a real turning point in the way we look at boxing films?
Yeah, I think Raging Bull, it's almost like with this book, I almost felt like Raging Bull should be a separate book, or it didn't really fit in certain ways, and that sort of speaks to how great of a film it is, because it really kind of turned some of those conventions on their head. Because Jake LaMotta, if you've seen the film, he's not a hero, far from it, and the film was sort of playing with a lot of these narratives that we see in the boxing film, and it wasn't presenting boxing as this sort of glorified pursuit. And I do think that it kind of made the boxing film a little bit more complicated, I think, in really interesting ways. It was also coming from a filmmaker who was identified, Scorsese, who's identified as being more of an auteur, and who people were coming to expect more kind of inventive things from. You know, this is somebody who's right off the success of Taxi Driver, right? And so, yeah, I think that Raging Bull was a kind of turning point, but you haven't seen a lot of films, a lot of boxing films sort of try to do that sort of stuff. And so in a way, Raging Bull kind of stands apart from what otherwise is a pretty predictable genre of films like you know, Requiem for a Heavyweight and Rocky and Body and Soul and stuff like that. So it's kind of tough to fit it in there. But it's interesting, too, because it did come right after Rocky and right after the success of Rocky. And in a way, it was kind of, you can kind of see it as a response
to Rocky.
That Rocky narrative, which, yeah, kind of, you know, and it's black and white. And, you know, it was really doing a lot of inventive things. It's kind of it's a pretty fascinating movie, but it doesn't really fit. It kind of stands apart from the rest of the genre in a really great way, I think.
Travis, how many boxing films did you watch in doing your research for the book?
Quite a few. I mean, I think I didn't count them, but there's a filmography in the book, and I watched them all in that are in the filmography.
Wow.
I think there are close
236, I believe I counted.
Is that what it is?
I think so. It might be. Yeah, I think that's what I counted. I don't have it in front of me right now, but I think that's what I counted.
That sounds about right. Yeah, that sounds about right. And there were, and I had to limit it. You know, I had to limit it to ones that were made in the U.S. because if I was going into the U.K. and India and Korea, I mean, that would just expand it even more, and it probably would have been double that number or close to it. So I had to kind of cut it off. I hope somebody does a book about global boxing films. I would like to read that.
Well, it really is a fascinating history of the sport and media's role, and is a wonderful read, The Boxing Film, A Cultural and Transmedia History. Travis Vogan, great to have you back on with us again. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Nice to talk to you.
See ya.
Bruce, Sportslit 101, a really wonderful book. Great conversation, as always, with Travis. And what have we got coming up next week on Sportslit?
Next week, we will be visited by the former Poet Laureate of North Carolina, Joe Bethanty. We talked to him about his wonderful book, East Liberty, about growing up in Pittsburgh. He has a whole bunch of new poems, including one which drives a dagger in my heart because it remembers with joy Mazeroski's home run to beat my Yankees. But he's got a bunch of really good new poems. The week after that, Kathleen Bashinsky, author of No Game for Boys, will be on with us. And the week after that, we're going to talk about a novel called The Red Shirt by Corey Sobel, which is a very interesting book. I've never really read anything quite about it. It seems to be thinly disguised account of his experience as a gay man on the football team at Duke. But it's never said to be Duke, and it's really interesting. I haven't finished it yet. I'm about halfway through it, but it's very good.
All right. We'll look forward to that.